Thank you. Good morning, everybody. And thank you to Robin, who invited me here. And also my apologies to Robin, because I did not follow his instruction to use Blackboard as much as he would have wanted. But I'll try to compensate it in full with this big projector screen. And I will go as slow as necessary, and the same rule applies. So you can stop me, you can shout, yell, anytime you like. Okay, now that's the formal title of my talk, One and Two Electron System in Strong ER and or XUV Fields. And when I say one and two electron system, it doesn't necessarily mean hydrogen and helium. It means one and two or two valence electrons outside the compact core. So this includes great many atoms, for instance, alkaline and alkaline earth metals, many others, and of course hydrogen and helium. These are the people involved in this project, and most of the calculation have been done by Igor Ivanov, who is based with me in Canberra. And Igor Bray is based in Perth, and we used a great deal of his code to deal with two electron systems. In the sense I described, it's like two active electron systems. And now we are doing even three active electron systems like lithium without freezing the K-shell. That's the theme of this presentation, numerically accurate atomic physics and strong field regime. When I say numerically accurate, how accurate? Well, on some instances, it's more accurate than experiment. And it's been proven that on many instances, it's been more accurate than the experiment. And of course, we developed some machinery, and we wanted to use this machinery in new regime and strong field, pulse, explicitly time dependent. And that's basically, I will give few example of few case studies, how it was implemented and what we achieved. As you know, I've come from very far away from very exotic corner of the world, so I have to give you some local flavor. And that's the typical Australian ground state. But make no mistake, it can jump to excited state in a split of a second. Unfortunately, I cropped this. This is the camera sent flying. Someone wanted to take a picture of this kangaroo, and it was unhappy. They're very territorial, and males can be very aggressive. Now, I have to talk about regimes of strong field ionization, and we were quite frustrated when we moved to this field, and we want to deploy our machinery. Our impression was that everything was done either classically or semi-classically, and there is nothing really left for us to do. We were very much impressed with simple things which worked so well. For instance, this famous three-step model attributed by some to Corkum et al. Actually requires back-on-the-envelope calculations. So you don't need any atomic physics at all to do this stuff. But the reason is the following. It's again the same story of Keldysh parameter. You have different regimes depending on this adiabaticity parameter. You can actually interpret it in either way of timing. So your electromagnetic field is fast or slow as in comparison with the tunneling time, or you can actually compare energetic of this reaction. So you can compare ponderomotive potential with ionization potential. And for large gamma values, you have multiphoton regimes, you have MPI or ATI, so you have all these peaks. And if you're lucky, if field is not terribly strong, you can work in perturbative regime. But then field grows and you start tilting the barrier. Now, and once you tilt the barrier, you can actually tunnel through the barrier. That's the Landau formula you can apply. And I believe that's what Keldysh did. I did not read his papers accurately or well enough. But basically, if you keep increasing your field, you end up in the situation when the electron is liberated. It can actually go away, accelerated by the field. It can come back, produce harmonics, this famous 3.17 UP cutoff law, or it actually can be accelerated to very large energies of 10, approximately 10 fundamental potentials. So this is quasi-classical, and this is classical. There is nothing left of atomic structure. Forget it about all these potentials. And that's what people did, and it worked spectacularly well. So we were so much impressed that we thought, well, there is no room for atomic potential, there is no room for electronic structure, and what do we do? But we came up, so gradually we came up with few interesting cases where there is need for electronic structure. And simple things like strong field approximation or this Delaunay-Krainov type treatment does not really work very well. And I'll give you a few case studies. And one is strong field ionization. It's single ionization of hydrogen at in infrared, very large intensities, 10 to 15. Not surprisingly, probably if you remember the yesterday's presentation by Alejandro, he showed that the SFA can be qualitatively right, but magnitude can be orders of magnitude off. So not surprisingly, that's exactly the case. But what is interesting here that actually there is experiment done. So in all cases, I have comparison with the experiment. Another interesting case is single ionization of lithium at about the same condition, slightly longer wavelengths and lesser intensities. And it's a weird situation. So on the one hand, the field intensity is sufficient to turn down the barrier. So we're above this over the barrier intensity, but we're still in the multiphoton regime. So, and once we're in the multiphoton regime, electronic structure is very important, and you can hit these resonances, and then you have resonantly enhanced multiphoton ionization. We have some results again in comparison with the experiment of Heidelberg, Max Planck Institute for Nuclear Physics. The last one is example where we need an accurate account for many electron correlations. It's double ionization of helium at XUV. And we want to do this resolved in time because photoionization until recently was solely province of energetic studies. So you know the energy of your probe and you detect your photoelectron and you know the energy conservation. If you have more than one photoelectron, that the energy of the pair is conserved. And then you can do all sorts of things. But you don't ask questions like how this plays out in time, what's happening. And now because people start producing very short pulses, they can actually ask these questions and answer them experimentally. So I will talk about it. And in particular, we are very interested to resolve in time various mechanisms of double photoionization of helium and single ionization of noble gases. Three case studies. If time permits, I hope yes, we have plenty of time. A little bit on our machinery, the tools we use. And we do things non-perturbatively. We do solve time-dependent Schrödinger equation, but the way we do it, we don't do brute force integration on the coordinate grid. We use basis-based integration versus as opposed to coordinate space integration. So we expand our wave function over some set of atomic states, either one electron or many electrons, and then we let the expansion coefficients vary with time, and we basically solved differential equation with respect to these coefficients. And for field-free atomic states, we use either Hartree-Fock states or two-electron convergent closed coupling states, and I will explain what this means. Importantly, if we have to deal with many electron continuum, it's horrendously difficult to integrate over more than one continuum electron state. In one electron system, that's fine. You can do ATI, no problem, in perturbative regime. But if you have more than one electron, all these Coulomb integrals become divergent. So you have to deal with this issue. And we discretize continuum. We use L-square representation for the continuum states. We build this L-square basis on the Laguerre states. So that's the field, which is on. And we solved the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Here I wrote it explicitly for two-electron system like helium. And that's the driving term. And we seek, as I said, solution on the basis of these two-electron states. We find them by diagonalizing our Hamiltonian. And they are not eigenstates. But and in a sense, they give very convenient representation of your continuum. When you diagonalize your Hamiltonian, you end up with negative energy and positive energy. Pseudostates, and you can show if the size of your basis n increases, negative energy pseudostates, they converge pointwise to true eigenstates of the system. But positive energy pseudostates, they don't converge to anything. They have no physical meaning, except they give you very convenient integration rule. Instead of integrating over continuum, you just sum over the positive energy pseudostates with appropriate weights. And it eliminates all the divergence, and incredibly convenient.
Sorry, Antoine, just to clarify your language, you said you diagonalize, but you don't use eigenstates. To me, saying you diagonalize means you're using eigenstates. So what do you mean when you say those words?
Okay. I mean that HPC H psi times phi is not equal by EI phi I. They are not solution of your Schrödinger equation.
But you said something about diagonalizing.
Eigenstates in the Hilbert space.
You're talking about
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I didn't hear that.
Yes, that's right.
I didn't hear that.
Okay.
But yeah, eigenstates in the limited space from the basis, but not for the real energy.
So the eigenstates of H, but they're not eigenstates pointwise in the Cartesian space.
I mean, if you said that as you enlarge the basis, the negative eigenstates approach the true bound states.
Yes. Pointwise.
What?
Pointwise in coordinate sense.
So is it okay if I understand it as it's a good approximation to the states bound in a continuum? Of course, instead of having a true continuum, you have a discretized continuum.
Exactly. Yes.
Where you have concentrated oscillator strength, and as you enlarge the basis, you go closer and closer to the real thing. Isn't that okay?
Yes, but the problem is these states, they have exponential fall off. They don't propagate to infinity. So for continuum electron, these states do not take you to the detector. They are only good for intermediate state integration. For instance, if you have perturbation theory expression, second order. So you have this set of states n, and you have to, instead of integrating over these states n, including this continuum, you just sum.
So the h that you use to define that pseudostate base is basically the phi sub i's are the diagonalized sum h, but that's not the h that you've written down.
No.
It's one electron.
It's some one electron.
One, exactly.
That you introduce.
Yes. Without field, of course.
So it's time independent, and you make some choice for the h.
Yes.
It's one electron.
And for helium atom in particular, it's just hydrogenic states of H double plus.
So Anatoly, part of the confusion is that the Hamiltonian, as you've written, it has the omega t in it, whereas down here, I think you're thinking.
Yeah, it should be H naught.
Different Hamiltonian.
It's H naught. And that's the confusion. And if you see, this is two electron Hamiltonian. Okay, let's put it H. Yeah.
So when you actually do the expansion for the time dependent wave function, do you use these phi sub I superscript n, or do you use the product form representation for
n? Yeah. That's n is there, and I is just N and L.
Notation is, if I may say so, confusing.
Okay, no, I'm
one colleague to another is making a pedagogical point.
No. That's.
I'm very concerned about your statement that you don't get pointwise convergence in the continuum. Is that somebody's theorem that I don't know about?
Again, but that's very simple to understand. True continuum states, they have asymptotic of Coulomb waves and at infinity. But these guys, they have exponential fall off.
Right, but at any finite distance, I think you do get convergence.
That's right.
So if you want to take this.
You've built them for years for atoms and molecules, and there is pointwise convergence, provided you know how to normalize them in the Dirac delta function sense, even though they have no asymptotic tail. That's the point I'm making.
But we because it's important for us, because we are interested in photoelectron angular and momentum distribution. So we have to take this function to the detector, and I'll show you how we do this.
Sorry, please do.
We go slowly, as I said. Okay, this should be lowercase h to satisfy everybody. But then, of course, time dependence is carried by these coefficients, and we solve this matrix equation with initial condition that at time zero you have the ground state of your system.
Since you use these hydrogenic states as basis, your matrix H there is a dense matrix, right? It has a lot of non-zeros, right?
Mm-hmm. Now,
can you back off a little bit? What is your R matrix on the left? The coefficients of ownership.
Since you're using my laptop, okay. And by the way, when you use a laptop, at least bring your own. When you're violating the rules, you should be expected to have your own laptop.
Okay. I don't have any. I thought this laptop belongs to KITP. Okay.
So what is this R?
I trust it. It contains all the overlaps.
But basically, you have different ionic states in your expansion. This capital N refers to different ions.
I'm sorry. Say this again.
The capital N refers to different ionic states. I mean, charge states. So you have.
Okay, so you're saying that the basis to use for the expansion is
not the No. That's why. That's very important. That's very important point. We use non-orthogonal, and we have all these overlaps, which are in this R.
Oh.
So R is also dense, right? Is R also dense?
I think so, yes.
Can you see what capital, no, can you see what capital N is?
Capital?
N.
That's the size of your basis. And that's very important concept. In this model, there is no adjustable parameters. So the only free parameter is the size of your basis. You basically increase this N to convergence. And that's what gives the rise to this term, convergent close coupling. Once you reach this convergence, if you put enough N and L and L capitals in your basis, and you presume that you reach the convergence, that's it. That's the answer. You have no more adjustable parameters.
What's the typical number of basis functions you include?
Okay. It depends on, it varies, of course, on the target. For helium, probably you need, and again, it depends on the quantities. For total cross-sections, probably you can end up with 15 pseudostates per channel, per L. But if you want to go to angular distributions, that you need considerably more. And again, if you go closer to threshold, it's very surprising. High energies, it's easy to do, but Vanier regime, you need horrendously many more Ls. And that's what makes this calculation very difficult near the threshold. We can't approach threshold lesser than 1 volt, probably.
So you said that those orbitals are nanothermal. Now I guess I'm confused, because if you apply boundary conditions that the orbitals vanish, say, at the origin and at some R max, and
we don't have R max. We don't have box. That's the beauty.
So how does that work? What is it you're doing then?
We calculate. We project them. We calculate them with finite R, and then. The cross section. Okay, there are two different recipes for the total cross section. We see if the one of the pseudostate has negative energy, then it's a single ionization to the ground state or single ionization plus excitation. If this pseudostate has positive energy, we attribute this channel to double photonization, and we just sum over all J, and we get single ionization cross section and double ionization cross section.
Now I, Joe and Robin, have been completely confused. So if you don't have an R cutoff, then all your single particle functions will get negative energies. Will have to be.
No, that's not true. Wrong. Do we have a chance to move anywhere further? But we are probably at slide number 5. I have.
Nevertheless, your basis states, as they have an exponential decay,
yes,
that is equivalent to having a finite box, since they decay.
They decay, yes.
I think you can clarify the situation if you simply write on the board how you calculate the price of I, because it's not just a matrix diagonalization, it seems.
If it is, then there should be a normal. Right. If he really means things comes over again, I don't think he means capital N.
In this business, we treat electrons, we distinguish electrons. Electrons are distinguishable. So there is one electron, this is helium. This is the nucleus. One electron, which is called inner electron, it sees the charge of this, unscreened charge of the helium nucleus. There is another electron which is called outer. This outer electron, it sees the screen charged, the evil one. So we describe this electron by Coulomb wave. That's a Coulomb. And this guy does propagate to the infinity, doesn't sit in the box. But this guy, has no chance to go to infinity. It, in a sense, it sits in the box, but it has exponential fall off. But strangely enough, it has both positive energy spectrum and negative energy spectrum. So it has the spectrum of J, which is greater than zero or lesser than zero. Now, the total cross-section of double photonization is the sum and single cross-section is the sum. Okay. Of the partial cross sections.
Can you please write down the equations you solve to get phi sub I? Just for my education.
And the inner one. And the outer one is a Coulomb. But how do you get the inner one?
Well, but you write Schrödinger equation. You write Schrödinger equation in radial form with the potential
but which basis do you use? I think this is the point.
It's Laguerre basis.
Laguerre basis.
Ah, okay. I told it. And I diagonalized this one electron Hamiltonian.
Sturmians,
yes. Okay. Okay. They're Sturmians, right.
So, but to connect the also notation, the two phis in there, they are not Laguerre's now. One is a Coulomb way.
One is a Coulomb way, another is.
We're not doubting what you're doing, you're just maybe understand the notation.
Please interrupt me.
So, 5R1 and 5R2 are different.
Different. Okay. No.
Well, they can be different, but they can be.
But I want to know what he does.
No.
Are they different or not?
If you really want to know, it will take 2 hours.
In principle, you can use any biases you like to expand your wave function. For, in a sense, this is kind of configuration interaction expansion. You can actually put any expansion in your calculation, and the price you pay, it's either rapidly convergent if you have a good choice, or it's slowly convergent. For this particular calculation, we use these pseudo states. And then, that's to describe the time dependence. When we project it to the detector, can I just move one slide further? I'll show you that maybe a little more.
Can I ask one thing? Not in the limitations.
I understand.
I want to understand. I mean, so since I'm not a quantum mechanical expert, what's the difference? And that's a little bit of an objection, because you started your introduction saying that there are a lot of classical calculations. But actually, the truth is that there were first quantum mechanical calculations by Ken Taylor. So what's the difference in what Ken is doing for 15 years now and this?
Oh, yeah, it's a world of difference, as they say in English. Ken is doing R1, R2, and he starts from the origin, and he propagated to large distance. You are listening or not? I'm sorry. Okay. So they use direct coordinate propagation. They have coordinate grid, fine enough. And they propagate from the origin. And they say, if you propagate along R1 and you go large enough on R2, that's single ionization. If you go in this direction and propagate there, it's again single ionization. Double ionization, if you go large enough along this axis.
So this is more efficient, or no?
It depends. The problem is, can't
understand what is the difference and why is it better, or if it's not better.
Okay. The difference is, here you couldn't care less about the angular momenta, because angular momentum is not in your basis. And what Ken Taylor is doing, he is doing double photonization of helium on ER, which takes 52 photons. If you try to do this, then we have to go to L equal 52, which is a little bit over the top. We can't do this. We can't drive.
Taylor has for each partial wave, he has such a grid, right? I mean, he has a couple of partial waves, right? Yeah. It's not that technically he's in grid.
That you'd better ask Ken Taylor. I'm not responsible. I was asked what the difference.
For angular momentum, this is more or less the same basis as you have.
And again,
this angular momentum has a two-dimensional hour and a two-basis grid.
But it doesn't use a basis.
Okay, let's stop this container.
No, he's giving a talk.
Wow.
He's giving
so
a talk.
Finish the environment.
Ken Taylor might be doing it like we do.
The matrix arises because the Sturians are spanning also the continuum.
Mm-hmm.
Is this correct?
In a sense,
so
yes.
To take care of that.
I span all the Hilbert space of my target. It's a good discussion. So people start talking to each other. So.
I think we should move on because at 11:30 the next group will come, and so we should continue with the talk.
So please, Anatoly, go on.
And now we have to take our system. We cooked it in the field long enough to produce a good soup, but now we have to try it. And to try it, we have to propagate it to the detector. As I said, to propagate it to the detector, this is in the electron, which is described by the pseudostate, and this is the out electron, which is described by the Coulomb wave. But now we have to project to get it to the detector. We need another Coulomb wave because this guy doesn't propagate far enough, and we make this projection. And what is exhibited here is the T matrix, which includes interaction to infinite order. And the beauty of infinity is that if you subtract one out of infinity, you get still infinity. And that's how you derive the equation for this wave function. And it's called Lippmann-Schwinger equation. And this is non-interacting term, which is, again, consists of Coulomb wave and pseudostate. And these are interaction tending to infinite order, and exhibited graphically here. And of course, you have to... propagate your system in the field up to certain time, t, and then you project it on time-independent wave function. Of course, there are some tricks because we test ourselves. The pulse is gone, but we let our system propagate field-free, and then we make this projection. And of course, there should be no difference, and that's how we test ourselves. Right. Now we come to real business, and that's the first experiment. This experiment was done in Australia. We have the establishment which is called Australian Research Center of Excellence for Coherent X-ray Optics, headed by Keith Nugent, and their idea was to image biological molecules. So they want to build table-tilt source of synchrotron radiation. So they want to do harmonics. And for these purposes, they generated this fairly short pulse. Not the shortest pulse you can think of, but short enough. But strangely enough, instead of molecules, they did hydrogen atom. So. But the field parameters were quite severe, quite extreme, because we have 10 to 15 watt on per square centimeter. And look at what we've got. At 10 to 14, we have already a gamma parameter equal.
Sorry, stupid question. What does T refer to as opposed to full width at half maximum? So what is parameter?
It's a waste. It's a waste of the pulse.
T is the period.
And ponderomotive potential is 0.25 atomic unit, and for this laser you have a strong field parameter very large of the order of 5. But what is more important, that if you look at this sort of three-step model, or on this instance it's two-step model, electron can be accelerated classically to 10 ponderomotive potentials. And at the cutoff, if you calculate how many photons it absorbed, it will be around 50. So it's sort of a very extreme regime of very strong field and sort of with great manifoldness absorbed. And if you look at the calculation, the spectrum of the photoelectron, again, as I said, it expands to approximately 10 from the motive potentials. But all the way you have these all wiggles, because even though when you go to 10 to 15, your Keldysh parameter is significantly smaller than 1.
Is this angle-integrated signal?
Yes, angle-integrated, but I'll show angle differential as well. Even though and to 10 to 15, you're already in tunneling regime, but you still see a lot of structure. But as Alejandra said, you transition from gamma larger than 1 to gamma smaller than 1, larger than 1 to smaller than 1. It's not instant. So even in the tunneling regime, you see traces of multi-photon regime. So you see all these little oscillations. And here you see them more clearly.
May I make a remark here? Even in the tunneling regime, you expect to see peaks in the electrons because there is interference between the two. Each cycle, you have two ways of ionizing the electrons, and you get a kind of Stukenberg interference. So you have peaks even in the tunneling regime.
Yes, we learned it. But as I said, first, when we moved to this field, we were sort of new to this field. We didn't expect it, but that's what we see, so it's not surprising. But again, and this is angular distribution at close to the threshold, one EV excess energy, not 50 photons, but large enough photons absorbed to have this complete mess. So we have so many partial waves that are very intricate angular distribution between transverse momentum and longitudinal momentum.
Actually, what is the difference between the left graph and the middle graph?
Adjust the scale. It blows up the scale. It's from 2.1 to 2.5. So you take this little oscillation and blow it up.
What you call probability, it's really like the differential probability.
Yes. And again, we did something. Again, I'm confused what to call SFA or ADK. But what we've done is just time integral of this matrix element, and we calculated it with the Volkov states. Let's call it SFA, just to see how much accurate atomic potential is necessary for this problem. And that just because we have experiment, we can make a comparison, and that's how this compares with the experiment. This is accurate solution of TDSE, and they have various intensities, and intensities are indicated in the box. It's not too bad, I would say, but if you look at SFA, it is completely off. And interestingly enough, it's completely off in the largest field intensity. And again, I should say that's a log scale.
Something is normalized to something, right? Because you have the data.
The data are internormalized.
Yeah, but I mean, they don't give you absolute number.
No, there is no absolute number.
What do you match? You match the lower one or what?
I think here we just match one point. And there is nothing actually to match because they deviate to different sides.
That I understand, but the left looks much better.
Okay, so they probably normalized it at this one.
I mean, you can slide the experiment versus theory.
But only once.
Only once.
So you match, for instance, if
I'm asking which one did you match? The middle one?
But this one, 2.7.
That one, down there.
Do you mean the whole curve or just at one point?
No. The whole, no, there's one point. Again, one point. So you there is no much liberty in the experiment. Or you can actually say experiment is normalized to this calculation at one point.
At one point of one
intensity. One intensity, yes. So you just nail this point, and you have no more freedom to move.
So surprisingly, you don't get very good agreement at low intensity.
No.
Or should I not be surprised?
That's the numbers. I can only say it's much better than SFA.
So was the experiment done for phase stabilized pulse?
I'm sorry?
Was your calculation averaged for phase laser pulse?
Yes, it's been horrendous amount of averaging. To begin with, the pulse phase was not stabilized, so it was carrier envelope phase averaging. Next. There is in these experiments there is something which is called focal point averaging, because you focus your laser, and interaction region is not homogeneous, intensity is not homogeneous, so you have to average along the waist of your laser pulse, a laser beam. And these people, we gave them raw data, not these are experimental intensities, but we produce calculation on a very fine grid of intensities, and we supply these intensities to these guys, and they reckon they did this all the necessary averaging.
So experimental error about intensity?
They say 10%.
Because typically, after good calibration, you have maybe a factor of 2.
Maybe
30%?
Again, there is a jitter in the laser pulse, and from short to short stability, again, it's an open question.
I am surprised that they didn't try to calibrate the data on the same curve for SFA and the TDSE. Apparently, they have used the data at 10 to the 14 for the SFA, calibrated then in some sense, and then at 2.7 for the TDSE. So there is a global shift, which is, I'm surprised about that.
But there is no way you can actually shift the experiment and calculation to match these points, because they are moving into different directions.
If you have chosen 2.0, 10 to the 14 for the TDSE, everything should be shifted up above these intensities. But then, well, I don't understand this.
Okay, I wanted to make only one point at this slide, that SFA does not work.
Well,
is it surprising?
No, I agree with that, but nevertheless. Now,
I can't actually comment on the quality of this experiment. It's unpublished data at the moment.
By which group?
It's a Brisbane-based group, and the leader is David Kilpinski.
Do you happen to know how high the dissociation rate was of the H2 molecules, or whether there was some kind of
there was a discharge source that I'm aware of, but I don't know how they gauge it, and that is beyond my control.
It must be a very difficult experiment.
Oh yes, it is. But it is, at least there is some data to play with, and this is a very crude demonstration that SFA is, as I said, there are some maniacs. Oh, as Alejandra said, there are some maniacs of SFA, and we wanted to beat them. Now, that's my...
Would you expect that your calculation is better for low intensities or high? Because actually I would have assumed low and then fix the point at your lowest intensity, and then it moves all up a bit. SFA would move up terribly.
And the uncertainty
experiment. Actually, again, let me just make a point here. If you calibrate,
I understand
your things here on this curve, SFA TDSE is good at low intensity, and becomes worse at higher intensity. Here, if the calibrated is here, if I understand.
Everywhere it will be particularly bad at large intensity.
They didn't calibrate it here, but if they had calibrated here, things would be a bit better.
But it's much worse here.
It would be really useful to see the theories compared directly.
Maybe.
Then you have no arbitrary.
Nothing new, I mean, to have SFA.
Right, it would show a quantitative measure. Of course,
But I would say the point is that the experimental uncertainty is the main point. It's not the error bars you see there, but if there is a 20% uncertainty in the, what was it? 10 or 20%?
What's 10% the uncertainty?
They quoted some ridiculous number, like 10%.
Yeah, but 10% would be still half.
I don't believe
of the
anything
curves.
Anything less than 5.2, I don't believe.
Well, this is log scale.
It's a
logarithmic scale. It's not linear.
Anatoly, you have not taken into account the expansion of the volume of the interaction.
No, we did. Not us. Them. Them.
They did.
They did it.
What do you mean? They do an experiment.
Yes, but the way it works, we because the interaction volume is large, and it you have to average over all the intensities in this interaction volume. The way we did it, we produce this calculation on very fine grid of intensities and supply to them. And they had a model how intensities distribute across the interaction region. They feed our data and they came up with these theoretical curves averaged over the interaction volume. So it's
But I mean, even if it's logarithmic or not, I mean, if you just say 10% of 2 times into the plotting, it would be 1.8.
No, not intensity. No. I mean the
uncertainty of the intensity.
No, that is something this is nominal intensity. Intensity measured probably in highest point. There is no, as I said. Intensity varies along across the whole interaction region.
I know that there's, you give me a number, which is a peak intensity, I guess.
Peak intensity, yes. That's a peak intensity.
Uncertainty of 10% in the peak intensity.
No. When I said 10%, it was uncertainty in their count rate.
Yeah, he's using intensity for two different things here: intensity of electrons and intensity of the light.
I'm speaking of the intensity of the light. The laser peak light.
Right. This is peak intensity.
Yes. And if I take 10% of that and I would make an error of 1.8, so
probably it's better than that.
So then the
I understand. I understand your point.
We just shifted to half between the 1.6 and 2. So I might say I would find this astonishingly good agreement. And I would really be surprised that, I mean, if they had really independently under control the intensity to such a high degree.
But you find good agreement there, right or left?
I'm speaking of the TDSE, I'm not caring about the SFA. I'm speaking about the TDSE, and what I'm trying to say is that if you take this curve with a peak intensity of 2.0, and you take an error of 10%, which would be, say, minus
of the
10%, then
make it a factor of 2.
I'm speaking of the 10%, and then you would be already at 1.8. Which means your red curve would be shifting, so to speak, in between this and this curve. So it would be here. So already this would say that the deviation between the TSE and the is astonishingly sensationally good. This is what I'm saying. If they really have an independent intensity calibration, it would be a sensation. Have you seen such a good intensity knowledge in any of the experiments? And you have much more experience than me. This is what I'm saying.
If I heard you correctly, though, the way they're getting the numbers in the boxes is by comparing to the TDSC calculation and finding the curve that fits best. And so,
but only at one point. There is no. You have to move the whole picture.
This is what I'm saying.
I think that's what I'm saying.
No. That's the second story. The story of lithium, and again. But here comes one complication. So that's the simple picture. I borrowed this cartoon from Alejandro's yesterday's talk. But I added one extra feature. And this extra feature is over the very intensity. And that's the field intensity. Yeah, sure. It's the intensity when you bend your field. And there is a simple way to calculate this bending intensity, and that's the formula. Right? So it's sort of very simple electrostatic formula. You bend your intensity when the field strength is related to ionization potential and hydrogenic charge. And if you go to the periodic table and you pick few noble gases and compare them with lithium, the difference is astonishing. That these noble gases, they are very tightly bound species, and that's why they are inert. But lithium is very reactive. It has very small ionization potential, and it's very easy to bend this potential. So you don't need a lot of field strength, for instance, in helium. It's a horrendous number, 10 to 15. But for lithium, you need only 10 to 12 to bend it. And also, the numbers play, and you can actually figure out what would be over the very intensity in watts per square centimeters if you know our ionization potential and Z. And also, these species, especially helium, you do bend your ionization potential in over the barrier regime or tunneling regime. What would you naturally suggest? But here it's weird. You bend your potential in multi-photon regime. So if you look at this diagram and you draw this over the barrier intensity, you're outside the lower order perturbation theory. You are in the multi-photon regime, and that's not easy for you, because you have to take into account all the electronic structure, because it's multi-photon regime. It's non-perturbative. It's essentially multi-photon, because it's between 4 and 5 photons you need to ionize. I'm not saying about ATI, so you need more photon to do ATI, and I'll show there is some ATI. So that's a problem for us. So you need accurate atomic structure to describe this problem, and you need to solve TDSE, because it's non-perturbative and the field is strong. Good. So, and that's a very long pulse. It's 25 femtosecond pulse on the full width at half maximum. It has probably like more than 30 oscillations. And the way you do it, it's about 1.5 volt energy in this photon. And the way you do it, you start from the ground state, and then you have a choice, either adding angular momentum or subtracting angular momentum in each transition, because they're all dipole transitions. So you need minimum 4 photons to end up in the continuum, and of course you can go on to ATI, 5 photons, 6 photons, etc. But you end up with 4 photons, either S, D, or G states. But also what is difficult, because of AC Stark shift, you can actually hit this manifold of Rydberg states. And then you have what is called resonantly enhanced multi-photon ionization. And the reckon they see it in the experiment. Of course, we have no control in the calculation, because we mix all these states, and they're all there, and they're Stark shifted, because it's just in the a strong field regime.
Could you go back to the previous slide? The one that had the formula for gamma over barrier ionization. I understand how you calculate the intensity, but how do you get turn that into a...
Okay, in our world, in our world, right, again, I think our intensity.
Capital gamma is the Keldysh parameter.
That's not accurate at the barrier top, is it?
No, you just take the square of it and multiply by some parameters.
I guess the question is that capital gamma, is that a Keldysh parameter?
It's Keldysh, I'm sorry. I borrowed this slide, it should be lowercase gamma Greek. It's Keldysh parameter.
Oh, it's Keldysh parameter. Oh, okay.
I mentioned it and I went, sorry for this.
Would you go to the next transparency, please, with a state? Right.
You just tell me where to stop.
Right. Now, I want to understand something here. I think this gray area above the LOPT, this bubble that you have there, correct? So this area, if I understand, you mean that certain states of the system become strongly coupled because of mere resonance. Is that right?
Yes. Okay. It may.
What?
It may become coupled.
Yeah, in that scheme, mm-hmm. if that's on scale, they will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, but you said you don't have to have that in your calculation?
No. Everything is in there. But yeah, so I it's hard to say which state is coupled.
Sure. But you do solve the problem with a good
absolutely
for the system.
And actually, we solved this problem with two sets of atomic potentials.
Okay, fine.
And we show some sensitivity to the choice of atomic potential, yeah, which makes this very good for electronic structure maniacs. Yeah.
But the structure shifts are in your calculation.
Yes.
It's in the soup. But
yes.
Okay, so now single active electron calculations, frozen core.
Yes, because it's 1.5 volt and lithium second ionization potential. It's close to 70, I think. Yeah. And what do they measure? These are very clever people in this Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg. The way they do it, they built up the reaction microscope. So they not only analyze the photoelectron for energy, but they also analyze this photoelectron for momenta. And because they have well-defined direction of the laser field, so they analyze it for longitudinal component and transverse component of the momenta. And what they see is ATI rings, because if you add squared longitudinal plus a squared transverse momenta, you get excess energy, which is defined by energy conservation. And if you look at this slide, you have 5.4, and you have 4 times 1.5, you have 6. Probably you have 0.6 eV excess energy, and that would define the size of this ATI ring. Even though it's not strictly ATI, it's MPI. That's the minimum number of photons. So this dashed line, it's what you get from the energy conservation. And this is experiment, and this is calculation. And now, and these are field parameter. You start with low intensity, and you don't bend anything. You're actually in very multi-photon regime. It's probably 1/10 of over the barrier intensity. Ponderomotive energy is very low, and Keldysh parameter is very large. So everything look as it should in multi-photon regime, but you start seeing these traces of ATI ring. These are 5 photon already. And even though you don't, and you see some shades here, but more clearly in the experiment. Again, there is this huge question mark, how you average over the interaction region. You put here peak intensity, but what's in there, no one knows for sure, except there are some realistic models.
Why is that a question mark, how you average over the volume?
You have to...
If the experimentalists give you...
No, they don't give me anything.
The focusing...
Unfortunately, it's one-way game. I give them everything, but... No, again, we calculate, well, we take very fine grid. It's very time-consuming calculation because we have very fine grid of intensities and we supply them and they have their simulation of the interaction region and then it's a quite involving. I have no control over it. But at least here, at least you see that it works more or less okay. So you don't see much. Like in the previous experiment, there were many more question marks, but this is, I should say, that's much more reliable experimental group, and we did a lot of work with them. And on most instances, they were right. And this is sort of ATI ring. Also, what is interesting, the number of these nodes tells you what is the angular momentum is. And for this, two nodes in one semicircle, it's D wave in the continuum. So even though from photons you can have S, D, and G, most contributing is D here. But again,
these nodes are signature of which angular momentum states?
G. L equal to?
The highest.
No, highest is G.
Not
the highest. Highest is G. But now you see things become, if you crank up your intensity and you are closer to over the barrier intensity, things start to get a little more complicated. This single line, multiphoton line, it splits. So again, this is the signature of onset of the tunneling regime. And we can go on and on and on. And this intensity up to 10 to the 14th. And here, we see different nodal structure. So we start probing different angular momentum. But also, experiment shows some serious splitting. For instance, here, and especially there. And we also see splitting in the experiment. But the most striking feature, look at the highest intensity. We are deep in the over the barrier regime. We annihilate this atomic potential completely. It's a huge number.
But fundamentally, the idea of the Kalish parameter is, as you said yourself, is an adiabaticity parameter. So of course, you at a certain point you would suppress it. But the idea, I mean, the whole concept here is saying it's so quickly moving that the wave function has no time to spill out, like in the tunneling regime. It has no time to tunnel. There's no tunneling time.
Exactly. So there is energetic parameter and timing parameter. And Keldysh parameter, as you think, is more timing parameter, or adiabaticity, as it was called originally.
In the spirit, you would not score on that side that the over the barrier is an important crucial point. So the question is, do you really see a difference in the sense that over the barrier comes in?
But what is important? Now, if you're in the multiphoton regime, you're expected to see a lot of structure in the photoelectron distribution because there are some traces of electronic structure of. But if there is no barrier, it's bent over, what people will think, you see structureless continuum.
On the other side of gamma.
Yes, but it's gamma, it's 0.8, so we are somewhere here.
Okay, then it's okay.
But let me just finish, and then I will take questions. But what they, you see that structure changes. Here you have angular structure, which is related somehow with the symmetry of your wave function with the angular momentum. But here you start having radial correlations. They call this fan-like structures, or ubiquitous fan-like structures. And first they observed it in the strong field ionization of noble gases. And there were a lot of debate where this structure was coming from. And the last word, I think it was from C.D. Lin and others, they said that electron, it tunnels out, accelerates, but it can return back to the parent ion and scatter on the ionic potential. And when it scatters on this ionic potential, you start seeing these strange structures. And we see a lot of them.
But it's the recollision, isn't it?
Recollision, yes. Except you don't have harmonic a generation. It's, there is no annihilation. There is no. It's a collision. Yes.
There must be some harmonic segments before. I mean, it's
no, but
there.
We look at the different sure. channel.
Yeah. In this experiment, we are not looking at that. Anyway,
yes. So. But I think it's kind of interesting and
yeah. One more thing, Anatoly. To see harmonic generation, you need some pressure there. You need a dense gas.
Yes, of course.
And you will never get a dense gas of lithium.
And you know, and actually, this was very difficult experiment because it was magneto-optically trapped target with probably 50,000 atoms at best.
What is the density per cc? Can you tell me?
No, I can't tell you that. But certainly not in the dense regime, and it was very difficult experiment.
So,
this would
be fairly. The intensity that you get is basically is peak intensity.
Peak intensity, yes.
Yeah, I guess it would be interesting to know when during the pulse ionization gets saturated, or to put it differently, does ionization get saturated for any of these pulses? Because it could be.
We actually looked at it. And with I don't think that's a problem at this. What may be happening, as I said, you put peak intensity here, but in fact, you're probably right. So because the pulse is very long, you ionize not at the peak intensity, but
before that. Yes. So it may never see that
yeah. time. And if you look at the experiment and compare with calculation, the best compares you take this experimental intensity and you compare with this calculated. So you're probably right, even though they put peak intensity here like this, but these atoms never have a chance to see that Hodge field.
The curse again.
The curse, exactly. The Lampropoulos curse.
I have to tell them. Well, they would not tell you, thank you.
Lampropoulos strikes again.
Sorry, is the bandwidth of the source consistent with the shift in energy from...
Yes, because, you have AC Stark shift, which for ground state it's down, for excited state it's up, but for ground state it's very little, for excited state it's a lot. And you see that observed intensity and observed energy and nominal energy is different. You have ionization potential goes up, so for the Lampian energy goes down.
So if you include that, the dashed line would go
yeah.
through.
But this line is not stark shifted.
Yeah, okay.
Anatoly, have you any interpretation of the minima you find?
Our problem is we have no none we can't say anything qualitatively we just cooked up the soup.
Because in terms of the energy,
we don't know where the structure is coming from, but they're interesting and they are there. And also on this sort of global picture, everything looks quite rosy, but if you look more carefully and pick up just one intensity, modest gamma parameter, and we just have two implementation of lithium potential. One is optimal basis representation of the Hartree-Fock, and that's just numerical potential to fit as many energy levels as possible, which is very brute force. And there are two calculations. Qualitatively, they look the same, but if you look at the energy spectrum, this is the main line. We just integrated over one of the momentum, keeping the energy conserved, and this is the energy spectrum. The black one experiment and the red one, one potential, and green one is another potential, and not terribly good. For the main line, more or less okay, but one potential gives you splitting. You see large splitting here.
The energies agree in these two potentials? If you plot the energy levels up to...
This one is, the red one is this Hartree-Fock.
No, I'm talking about the atomic energy levels.
Are they all the same? Atomic length, both potentials, we judge on the quality of these potentials by fitting these energy levels. And again, but the problem is you never deal with bare energy levels. They're all stark shifted. And how well they are stark shifted depends on the choice of your potential. And we have no control. Of course, we can control field-free potentials. We make sure they're good enough to as many significant numbers as we can. They're both good potentials.
But I mean, the energy determines most of the dipole matrix. We know the Bates-Damgaard method, for instance, works very well for alkali atoms. And once you know the energy, this controls most of the dipole matrix elements.
I'm not sure I understand. You said that you don't have control over the stark shifts. Now, if you have a model which gives you good energies,
yes,
in a good way.
But the problem is both potentials give us good energies.
Good, well, fine. And if you also have good wave functions,
and that's what we can't say. Which, but how can we say which potential gives you which
you
potential gives
radiative lifetimes at right. least for the peak state, which is
we didn't control that. We didn't control the oscillator strengths. Probably it may be a good idea to calculate oscillator strengths and see which is better.
Polarizability.
Because it's really a few states.
But this is atomic data tables. These people give you only energy levels. They don't give you.
You have to calculate the dipole moment.
Yes, we can, but we did not test it. But as I say, for this structure, it's even worse. So this structure is multiplied by 10. This is 4 photon MPI, and this is 5 photon ATI. And both calculations are very different from the experiment. I'm not saying which calculation is better, but they're both very different from the experiment. So it's a lot of work to do. Maybe that's a new way of doing things. That's very, very inventive, yes. Now, finally, at the end of the talk, that's the last topic. And that's only half cooked, because that's only ideas. We have not completed yet. And the conception, okay, let me just talk about mechanism of helium double photonization. You have one photon, you have to emit two electrons. The only way of doing this is through correlations, because you can couple non-relativistic photon to only one electron. Second electron has to be attached to the first to go together. And the way they do it, there are two different mechanisms. One is called shake-off mechanism. So you remove one electron from the atom by XCV pulse.
Sorry, could you go back just 1 second on the previous picture? The comparison between the two potentials. There is a thing I am surprised that they are not shifted, by the way. No. Okay. No question.
Now I'm talking about correlated two-electron emission. The two previous topics were peanuts as compared to this one, because they were one-electron transitions. You don't need much correlation. You just need accurate potential. But here you do need correlations. And the way it can play up is the following. You can couple this XUV photon to only one electron. And then what happens to the second guy? Second guy feels very uncomfortable, because now it feels a lot of Coulomb drag, and it goes to the nucleus, and in classical picture, it accelerates and then can actually be either captured on one of these lower lying orbits, will be shaped up processes, or it can actually miss the nucleus completely and go to the continuum, and that's what's called shake-off. Now, when you do that, if you talk in terms of quantum mechanics, you have two sets of target states, one of eigenstates of the neutral helium, and this guy is sitting in 1s eigenstate of the neutral helium. But then, when it's ionized, environment changes completely. It's not eigenstate of the helium plus, and it, you can project this 1s to various eigenstates of helium plus, and you have some spill out to the continuum. But to do this, you have to change the field very rapidly. So it's a fast process. You have to remove this electron quickly, or if you do this slowly, this electron will have enough time to adjust to new environment, and it will stay in 1s pretty much. So this process takes place when you have a large energy of the photon, and then energy of this photoelectron is large, and it goes away very fast. So you typically have a large contribution from this process away from the double ionization potential. So your photon energy much larger. And what is the opposite? The opposite are, okay, interestingly, how to estimate the time of this transition? It's very crude estimation, but you can actually look at the energies of the non-relaxed state and the fully relaxed state. And if you take inverse of this difference, you end up with something like 20 out of seconds. So it's a very fast process. And what's the opposite? The opposite is known as recollision in strong field physics, but it's more a common name, knockout, in a low field physics. Or they call this two-step one mechanism, believe it or not. But I don't like this term. We call it recollision or knockout. So what's happening here? We know what's happening here. You accelerate your electron, but it comes back and hit the second electron and knock it out from the target. It has to be slow, because for this electron to absorb more energy, it should not travel far away, because if it goes far away, it will never return. So its dominant mechanism close to double ionization threshold. So between the two extremes, and how you estimate the time of this process? Well, again, it's very crude estimate. Let's just take the helium atom bound state. And we calculate the best. We let this electron be independent, and we take the best hydrogenic model, which is Z effective, which is 1.785, if I'm right. And we take the fully correlated energy and take the inverse of this best uncorrelated energy and fully correlated energy. So it's inverse of correlation energy. And we end up with 200 at a second. Now that's typical time of electron correlations in neutral helium. And because this electron goes slightly farther away than the size of the helium atom, it probably would be larger than that. Real recollision time would be probably in a few hundredths at a second, maybe femtosecond. But importantly, these are vastly different times. So they're vastly different processes, fast and slow. So. And people knew this, the first labeling of these regimes was done probably in late 70s. People knew already that double photoionization can take place, and they start looking about, thinking about the mechanism, and they came up with these two models.
Anatoly, there is a third diagram, so-called initial state correlation.
This initial state correlation, it's here. I did not want to model more. But it's called ground state correlation. And the way ground state correlation plays, you can think of ground state correlation in very simple terms. Normally, 99.8% of the time, helium atom stays in 1s square state.
Right.
But on very short interval, it can actually go to virtual doubly excited states, to S squared, 3S squared, whatever. And of course, the probability to find your helium atom in this doubly excited state, it's very little. But if it's in this doubly excited state, shake-off probability is added incredibly, because if electron is further away from the equilibrium, then when you first, it's much easier to remove. These are two 1s electrons, but imagine they are in some highly excited orbit. So this process will be greatly accelerated. So if you want to calculate shake-up probability, you'd better use fully correlated ground state. But for this process, it's absolutely inessential. And this process is not affected by ground state correlations, but this is affected immensely.
So you're saying that you lump the initial state correlation in the upper diagram?
Yes.
However, that diagram is important even at low energy.
No.
But then it's...
It's a technical question, we talk about it.
Let me not take it.
But what is important is that even though people were talking about these two different mechanisms for ages, or for decades, that's for sure, no one knew how to actually separate them. And the problem is, if you write diagrams, for instance, you can actually assign one diagram, and ground state correlation against the third diagram, so you don't know really where to assign it, but the problem is it's very gauge dependent. The trick is, the sum of the two processes is gauge independent, if you calculate it with good wave function. But individually, they're very gauge dependent. So there is some way of splitting them, but it's sort of, again, very gauge dependent. This is velocity gauge split. And as you see, this is shake-off contribution, and this is knock. Out contribution, near threshold, everything is driven by knockout, but at away from the threshold, like 500 volt above the threshold, it's shake off. And there was only one measurement at 1.450 eV, and they actually basically confirmed that most of it is just shake off. But it's very tempting to distinguish these processes on the basis of their timing. Their timing is very different. And if we can...
But shouldn't you be able to distinguish them by just looking at polarization dependence of light, circular polarization?
We did it by looking at the angular distribution of the photoelectron. At least these experimental people were able. Because if one electron takes the whole of the photon, its angular asymmetry parameter is 2. You start with S wave, absorb one photon, you end up with angular, but shake off electron, because it emits fully symmetrically, so it has angular symmetry parameter equal to 0. And looking at these vastly different asymmetry parameters, you can actually separate them. But that's only done, you need very large energy to do this, because in the middle, everything is muddled, mixed up, no clear separation.
Sorry, the recollision cartoon you had on the previous slide isn't relevant to this process.
No,
it's
field-driven.
The collision happens on the way out. The electron.
There's no recollision.
It's a collision, not a recollision.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
The two electrons are tied by a string.
Yes.
One electron absorbs the photon and pulls out the other electron because they are correlated.
Or you can.
It's not that the electron comes back at that frequency.
Okay, you can. I use.
It's a convention theory.
Okay, recollision is from high field.
Recollision has a very specific technical meaning. This.
Okay, I'm sorry for using this jargon liberally.
Yeah, and it should not be used here, and it should not be used for high. For
okay.
Unless the intensity is big enough. Okay.
You defeat me.
Otherwise,
okay.
It's be
I'm beaten hands down. Now, can we just do something else? And roughly 1 year ago on this venue, I was taking part in another program, and I've heard of this work. Done by Misha Ivanov and his collaborators, and I came up with idea how to use this technique to separate different correlated processes. I hope, I very much hope Misha would have been here, and he was scheduled to be here, but for some reason he did not come. So I have to talk about his work, and I do this very briefly. So the idea is how to use electron correlation to make other second measurements without other second pulses. So it's very sort of attractive idea. Up to now, the best, the shortest pulse, as far as I know, it's probably like 80 arcs at a second pulse. And here where we're talking about processes of 20 at a second. So we need something shorter than that. But the way they do, they produce these at a second pulses. They start with femtosecond infrared pulse, nearly single oscillation, at least in the latest experiments, and then they these pulses can be very rigidly phase stabilized, and this means that delay from this pulse to and they use harmonic generation to produce XUV, which is phase locked to this ER, and then they have combination of two fields ER and XUV, which are very sort of time, very rigidly time locked with the precision of several tenths of arc second. So we have a what is called arc second stroboscope. Some people call this arc second striking camera of incredible precision. And that's the idea, to use this sort of arc second stroboscope for these measurements. And the way they do it, they looked at the Auger process. They use XUV pump to produce primary photoelectron. And then it takes some time for the atom to readjust to this vacancy. And most likely adjustment is to take one of the valence electron down to fill this vacancy. And the second valence electron goes to the continuum. And that's Auger process. And Auger process is it has very precise timing. The timing of the Auger process is known. And there was a Nature paper, actually, by Dreschler and others to measure the timing of the Auger process using their sort of short pulses. But Misha is saying that we don't need other second pulses as such. We can actually do something more inventive. And the way is just to strike this Auger electron with infrared field, which is phase locked to this XUV pulse. Even though XUV pulse is produced from this ER, by time delay, they can be actually coming at a later stage. So they have some different tricks. They can actually subject the atom to XUV first and then ER second. And what will happen, because of the this Auger electron in the continuum, it can either absorb or stimulatedly emit photons. So instead of one Auger line, we will see unshifted line and infrared shifted plus omega and minus omega lines. And then we let them interfere. We overlap them. And once we have interference of two lines with different frequency, we can actually get phase information, because interference term depends on the phase. So if you look at the Auger electron energy relative to, because the pulse is very short, so you have energy broadened Auger line, and phase goes to the it's energy dependent phase through this line. So you can either measure timing of arrival of this pulse directly, or you can actually measure energy dependent phase and reconstruct time dependence through the Fourier transform. But you need this phase over the whole energy range to do that properly.
Can I ask something? So what's the difference? Why do you start with this paper and not the one electron streaking camera? What's the difference?
No difference at all.
Okay, because it was earlier.
No, but again, you okay. Streaking camera is a timing, direct timing measurement. Here, you don't do timing measurement as such. You analyze phase. You convert, you get energy time dependence from energy dependent phase. And it's very well known from quantum mechanics. And there was a report and review report on progress in physics on how to convert energy dependent phase into time delay.
So I think there was even an experiment, not with this, with that kind of field, but actually an attosecond measurement without an attosecond pulse that used what you actually started with earlier, this discussion, this argument that the Auger rate is a fairly reliable clock, or provides a fairly reliable rate. And in Wilfried Wurt's group, they basically looked at electron transfer on a surface from an absorbed atom
yes.
to the surface.
But there was
basically clocked that with the Auger rate. It was actually caused the chronic decay, but some kind of Auger decay.
But here, it's not experiment as such. It's a Gedanken experiment.
I understand. I'm just saying.
This is not. This is paper. It's a proposed measurement scheme produced by theorists alone. What they want to demonstrate that if you take experimentally achievable parameters, including the jitter, you still get Auger decay profile very accurately. But of course, there is no point of applying the scheme to Auger decay because Auger decay timing is very well known. The whole point to apply this process to is apply the scheme to the processes, timing of which are not known. And for instance, and that's they call this correlated attosecond two-electron optical reconstruction. Now that's the jargon. But it all comes from this sort of phase reconstruction. So this is evolution of this is older scheme, but now they want to do this for two electron processes because they want to have spectral phase along large energy range. So they take natural widths of the Auger line and determine the phase along the whole range of spectrally broadened Auger line.
When we say two electrons, the two electrons that we are saying that they want to do it is the two electrons.
Right.
And two electrons in the continuum or one electron?
They are both in the continuum because Auger electron, it's a double ionization. First electron is knocked out by the photon, a second follows up, but it's not, it's
what kind of photon? Yeah, that's what I'm
it's sequential double photonization.
Okay, great. That's what I wanted to understand.
Okay.
Because before we talked about correlated.
Correlated, and this is sequential.
It requires term correlation. That's what correlation is. It's not the second dimension.
Exactly, but that's what I wanted to understand. But in one case, we want to strip correlated electrodynamics, and in the other case, we want to strip sequencing. It's they're sticking sequencing, but there's a difference. And I want to point that out.
Auger is sequential, but exactly. The real interest is non-sequential and correlated. Exactly. And that's where I want to go. And that's, as I said, in helium atom, in our jargon, we have two electrons. One is, you can think, you have 79 eV of a helium atom. You can actually split into single ionization potential, which is 24 eV, and double ionization and second ionization potential of helium plus, which is 4 Rydbergs. And you can actually think of electron inner and outer electron. It's a very, very simplified jargon picture. I want to make a connection with the previous slide. And that's the photon comes in, and we know that electrons are attached. You can't actually remove one without removing another. But that goes the first electron, produce one line, and that goes the second electron, which produces the second line. But in reality, they are attached, and you get all the energy in the middle, because only the total energy of the photoelectron pair is conserved. Right? So what you see is not this what you would see in the sequential process, like in Auger. But in correlated process, you will see something like this. You have energy E1 versus energy E2, and E1 plus E2 along this straight line is conserved. But of course, this is pulse calculation, so you have some broadening of the spectrum. And you have the photon energy, it's about 16 volt over the double ionization threshold. Unfortunately, you can't hardly see the scale here, but it's really what it is. But it's a fake color. Here you see more intensity at the extreme energy sharing than at the even energy sharing. Here it's E1 equal E2. Why so? Because energy distribution in this regime is U-shaped. So for the photoelectrons in this game, it's much easier for one electron to take the whole energy and go away quickly, and for second electron to get away. Because what was happening? It's a sacrificial game. One electron, in electron, hangs around the nucleus and shields the outer electrons from the drag. So it's much better. Not much better, it depends on the excess energy. At this energy, it's slightly U-shaped. But if you go further and further away from the threshold, it becomes extremely U-shaped. And that's the sign of the shake-off, because one electron takes the full energy of the photon and whole angular momentum of the photon, and another shake-off electron is very slow. It has very little energy. And of course, because electrons are indistinguishable, we have one half of this curve, and then we have to flip it horizontally. So here, electron 2 takes the whole energy, and here, electron 1 takes the whole energy. But that's not the whole story. What is interesting, if we superimpose infrared field, do we get this sort of interfering pattern? Well, that's what happens as before, but now we and that's the previous slide, but now we send this ER field, and in Auger picture we have the split plus omega minus omega, but in this two electron correlation picture, what would we see? Anyone's guess?
What was the question again?
We have XUV photon,
yes.
And now we send another infrared photon.
Yes. What's this striping in the equal sharing region?
That's what we see. One before, we have only one line, and now we look at plus photon, minus photon. So this 16 eV energy is shifted downwards and upwards by 3 eV. One goes down, that's minus omega, and one goes up, that's plus. So we are ready if we just, and this intensity plot, but of course we have amplitude plot. So what we have to do now, we just have to take interference of these terms and get phase. Of course, it's much more than that, because these are theoretical simulation. Now we have to take realistic pulse parameters. We have to get the jitter into account, and again, it's half done. It's just for the purpose of demonstration. And most interesting, that's half done.
Why,
and
why do you call 3D infrared? 3D is not infrared.
Well, that's the second question. Our trouble is we have to propagate here the already the ratio of energies is 30. So we have to take, we can't take very long pulses. And that's the compromise, because here we have at least 3 oscillations in this pulse, and already in this pulse we have like 90 oscillations. But that's not what, and that's the best we can do. If we take this energy down, the period of this will be much larger. So we will have like 100 or 200 oscillation in this pulse. It's very difficult for us to propagate such a pulse. Again, it's not ready yet, but it's just some demonstration that you can do this.
But I think a more interesting regime would be where you have a short XUV pulse.
And that's what realistic. That's
so because you have, you say you have a very long XUV pulse, which actually ends up averaging over many of different phases of infrared field.
Uh-huh.
So and that tends to wash out the interference picture. So if you also have short XUV pulse, which would come at specific phase of infrared, which would be an experimental setup if you're doing it for.
That's what I said.
It would have a much clearer interference picture, because at the moment you just have like the side bands from infrared and that's left.
But they are not bands, they're strips. Because it's like the bands people saw before, that's the first time they see these correlated strips shifted.
Yeah, yeah, sure, fine, yeah.
So I like the idea a lot, but are you aware that we have a paper in the Los Alamos archive in March of 2010 on exactly the same, it's exactly the same, it's in the two electron strip camera with Paul Kostum and Andrew Stout.
I'm not.
But I like your idea a lot, but it is on the Los Alamos archive.
But if you send me a link?
I will, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just for the record, Ogier is sequential. There is a coherent Ogier, which is non-sequential, just as there is absorption followed by emission versus resonant inelastic light scattering. The two are similar. Both have been measured. Both processes are routinely measured.
Okay.
The first experiment done at the SSRL at Stanford was just that.
Mm-hmm. And that's where I want to stop. That's a very sort of new stuff, and it's, I think it's April science paper. And that's the views. The title of this paper was actually different, but there was accompanying views and newspaper written by Hugo van der Hart, and he gave it this title, When Does Photo Emission Begin? And these guys, they used tracking camera, and they observed that if you send a short light pulse on the neon atom, then you have different delays before electron is emitted from 2S shell and 2P shell. And surprisingly, 2P shell takes more time to emit electron than 2S, and exactly by this strange amount, 21 plus 5, plus minus 5 at the seconds. And if they do this sort of SFA type calculation, they can't do anything better than this for this 8 electron system. They got only 6.4, so it's a huge difference, and they don't know where it was coming from. Again, 1 year ago, we discussed this process with Misha and the ideas, but again, our assumption was just completely opposite. Because what's happening, because of the intershell correlation, RPA type correlation, and Tony Storrs was talking about these type correlations, you can actually emit 2S electron by two different ways, either by direct photon absorption or through the correlation. Because 6p electron outer shell, it's very well polarizable. You polarize it, and you induce this dipole momentum, and this dipole momentum eject 2s electrons. So our hypothesis was that 2s electrons will take more time to eject than 2p electrons.
Could you say more about the pulse?
Yeah, what wavelength are we talking about?
Oh, I can tell you more. So
there are 5 minutes till the next time.
So okay, they started with 3.3 femtoseconds ER, and then they produce harmonics, and these harmonics were sub 100 at a second extreme XUV at 100 eV. Energy, sub 100 femtosecond. But then they strike these electrons with ER field. So it's a sort of quick effect at a second striking camera. They use